Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett McMillan with the Perry Johnson Companies and Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety. We're really excited for our first webinar today for our Croptober series. I'm really excited to have on board Scott Wall of New Age Laboratories and Anthony Silvernail of the Kentucky Organic Hemp Co-op. Today, we're basically going to have an open conversation about the science of hemp and what's going on in the fields. And for those of you participating, some of you may have already experience as being a hemp farmer. You might be a processor doing CBD oil, or you may actually just be trying to learn about the hemp industry as a whole. Perry Johnson Food Safety, we are part of the Perry Johnson family of companies. So we are a global certification company for most major ISO certifications, and relative to the cannabis and hemp space, we have also launched good manufacturing practices checklists, which are industry recognized. We're also recognized by the USDA for certifying organic. And we just want to talk about hemp today and what's going out in the fields and lessons learned from the harvest. So let's just dive into it here. Get the slides to move forward here. So that's myself, Brett McMillan. And we also have with us Scott Wall. Scott, you want to just kind of give a quick introduction of yourself and tell us about New Age Labs?
Sure. I've been in the commercial laboratory industry for over 25 years. Kind of started in the environmental industry. We've expanded out into agriculture and horticulture with food safety as a complementary service. Big part of our agricultural horticultural services is supporting the industrial hemp and medical cannabis industries. So here at New Age, we are one of two laboratories here in the United States that do a specialized analysis called plant sap analysis, which looks at the nutritional profiles with nutrient uptake in crops, which is probably one of the most dynamic tools that we've run across in the last 20 years. And we're really excited about it. It's growing in popularity and application. So that's a big plus that we see in the industry. And, as a whole, the cannabis space, whether it's hemp or whether it's marijuana, this is an industry that is hungry for science-based information. And so we're just really honored to be part of that movement forward.
Great. Okay, and also we have Tony Silvernail. Tony. Tony is with the Kentucky Organic Hemp Co-op and also his own farm Beyond the Bridge. Tony, welcome. Glad to have you back again. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy out in Colorado right now. Give us a little bit of background, Tony.
Okay, you'll have to excuse me. Where I'm at here, I'm in Grand Junction, but service, I'm in and out, so hopefully you're hearing this right now. Yes, yep. I'm an organic farmer of hemp. And I just been into the hemp field space the last couple of years. Prior to that, I was a researcher at Kentucky State. And when they first started bringing the hemp pilot program into Kentucky back in 14, we were doing grain and fiber there at the university initially. Now I'm more into the cannabinoids, looking at that. And that's what brought me out here to Colorado right now at the moment. But yeah, we do have a small group of growers, and like a lot of growers from last year, we ended up eating a lot of hemp. Unfortunately, there was a huge glut last year, and we're still sitting on some we had from last year. So lessons learned, we're still learning. Like Scott was talking, and as Brett will mentioned too, you know, this is a real nascent baby industry, essentially, when you're looking at all the other major crops that are out there that are established. Hemp, we're just still learning. And as a grower and as a past researcher, I can tell you that there is a lot of information that, like Scott was saying, that does need to get out there. And hopefully now, with everybody working together on a state level and actually hopefully more on a federal level too, information will get out to the growers and will get out to the processors and stuff like that to make this more of an efficient industry and one that can benefit everybody and not just a choice few.
Great. Well, that's the whole point of these webinars for our Croptober series, is just to bring information out there and use science to the best ability so we can all grow and learn from this industry and from this plant. So let's just dive right into it. I've got a basic series of slides here to kind of trigger some talk points for the varying people that are on the show and on the webinar. Tony, like you said, you're a ground pounder, you're out there in the dirt, and you know, Scott's in the lab. What is a traditional harvest point for hemp? Give us a little background of, you know, how long is the grow cycle? When do most people start thinking about their harvest?
I'll give you a framework from being in Kentucky. Last couple of years, we had been putting it in May, and we were still harvesting right around September, the end of September. This year, I put mine in the week after the 4th of July, and I've still got just monster plants. And we're looking at, it did push it back a little, but not as much as I thought. We tested this past week, and we'll probably be harvesting roughly around the first week in October. In Kentucky, that's sort of the range that you're getting, anywhere from roughly the third week in September up to the end of October. There are some people that are doing autos, and I don't know if you want to get into like the auto varieties of the hemp that are out there that are going a little earlier. And then there's some varieties that people almost wait till there's frost on the ground. You know, it really depends on the varieties and the experience that the people have with those varieties. Because I know people that were still harvesting and they were still good all the way up into November last year. I mean, we sort of up until then we had a really, really hard frost, like the second week in November last year. And then everybody was done. But yeah, I mean, you can push it around. I mean, the biggest limiting factor will be the state testing, as we touched upon, about making sure that it doesn't go over the 0.3 and that you're well within the bounds of, you know, being able to harvest it and stuff. So, I mean, okay. And that's a varietal difference, you know, and there's a lot of factors that are playing into that right now. And Scott could probably reference that a lot more, what he's seeing from the lab testing and everything like that. So,
right. And that's gonna bring up my next slide here, which is really going to be a lot of the meat and potatoes of what we're talking about today, and also what has triggered a lot of questions to us as a certification body for the science behind all this. Let's talk about, you know, with the USDA requirement on the THC level, when do you start testing for THC? When do you start timing your harvest? Do you have to be 15 days out, 20 days out? What have you seen, Scott, in the lab? Are folks doing sequential testing to know when they need to harvest, or what does it look like from your end in the lab?
Well, I don't think anybody's really thinking about testing until they start getting bud formation. Okay. You know, that's their first thought. And then they start thinking about, okay, let's start getting into taking a look at that. Now this year with the sap analysis, we've started looking at THCAs and the other acids, CBDA, CBGA particularly, because we know that's the precursor to THCA. And so we've started looking at that to see if we can get a gauge on nutritional profile and see if we can start projecting out earlier in the vegetative states as to whether or not we've got a variety that's going to go hot on us. So we do have growers. I wouldn't say a lot. We do have growers that are starting to take earlier samples and try to get a an idea of, you know, where are they sitting with THCs? And of course, we're looking, having to look at the total THC. I think that that got clarified a little bit more because some states were just looking at the Delta 9. And right. I think that's been clarified that it's now got to be the total. Would you agree with that, Tony?
Yeah, in Kentucky, they were always considering THCA and Delta. So yeah, because most of what you'll find, I mean, what we've seen in hemp is most of it is THCA, the acid precursor or whatever for that. And I mean, if they just did Delta 9 levels, which everybody was hoping for, like, ooh, we all could get in. No, we wouldn't have that much of an issue.
Right.
But yeah, that's not the case. So.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the final point there in terms of seed choice and genetics. You know, there's folks that are going for industrial hemp. There's folks that are growing, knowing that they're going to be extracting for CBD. You know, our sister company, Perry Johnson Lab Accreditation, which accredits testing labs to ISO 17025, like Scott and his lab is. We've seen a lot of certificates of analysis for, you know, seeds that are proclaimed to be 0% THC and such. What's your opinion on the seed industry right now, Tony? And how confident are you that you know, that if you plant a certain type of seed, that you're going to be able to, you know, have faith that you're not going to test hot for a THC level? Has that been working out for growers and farmers?
Well, the seed industry is a monster. I mean, in my mind, I mean, there's a lot. We're talking about COAs and stuff, and I really believe, I mean, there's got to be a better tracking system than just that with seeds, because people, you know, a lot of nefarious activities, you know. And I'll try not to curse here, because I was telling you earlier, we bought seed where the COA was saying all this, and consistently across the board, that it pushed to like 1.3. That did, and like it was nothing close to the COAs in which the guy was selling it as. And I mean, I think the lessons we learned, I mean, we last year and this year both, we've gone small as far as the number of plants per type variety till we actually get something that we can depend on, you know, and stuff like that. And that's part of just being a new industry, you know, like feminized seed. You know, there's issues with that. You know, we bought some feminized seed that was actually good. It had good germination, and it was about 90% female. Where another company, and they were consistently bad. These were all out of Kentucky. We only had like 50% germination. We had 50% male out of them. So wow. When you're paying a buck a seed, and you're only getting 25% of the plants, that's actually, yeah. So then you're actually paying $4 a seed. At that wow. point, yeah, that makes you curse a little bit. And, you know, but then, you know, we're all doing these all in small sections, like 1500 to 2000 plants per type variety. So, you know, you learn your lessons, you take your spanking, you move on. But yeah, the seed industry, because of the variability of the genetics, and a lot of it hasn't really been, you know, backbred to really sort of get that stabilized. You know, there is so much variation with these plants right now. And I'm hoping, you know, as we go along and as this industry grows, that does become more, you know, more consistent for farmers, for growers and stuff like that. Because I mean, there is the option of clones, which are more consistent, but you know, in Kentucky, we hit droughts and stuff like that, hot droughts, and the clones don't do too good then. You know, whereas a traditional plant with a taproot does really well. We had that last year where we saw that. So, I mean, okay. There's a lot out there, a lot of different opinions, and you know, so you know, just it's a buyer beware type thing. You got to be careful of.
Interesting. So, Scott, what have you seen on the lab end of this? I mean, it seems like there's legitimate testing being done on the seeds by legitimate companies. Is there just too much variance or not enough detection limits, or what's your science opinion on that?
I think that there are, I think the cannabis industry, whether it is hemp or marijuana, has been an industry that has been preyed upon by a large variety of people that are interested in capitalizing on profit. And there are very good individuals in the industry that are earnest and well-meaning. And there are people that are have no scruples at all and will do just about anything. And you have to be, you have to do your research. If this is an industry that buyer beware is probably top on the list, and you should always check your references on whoever you're working with. It's, you know, mm-hmm. when you talk about doing vendor validations, you know, making sure that your vendors have credentials and stuff. This is an industry that it's almost mandatory. I mean, folks are paying way too much money for the things that they're paying for. They deserve to get quality, you know, and support.
Understood. Okay, well, let's get to the next slide. Here's some more talk points. So during the harvest, Tony, what are some of the hurdles that happen in the field that are lessons that you've learned, not just with the THC, but maybe with the moisture content or mold or things like that in terms of the timing of the harvest? What are hemp farmers up against during this time?
Yeah, it's really tough. Space, my biggest issue was space. The last couple of years I've been, you know, initially people in Kentucky, everybody looks at like tobacco and says, okay, this barn will hold this many sticks, will carry, you know, so many acres, you know. And I was sort of using that same spatial reference for my hemp, and we ended up being very short on space. Last year specifically, and that was the plant size, and you know, we were very successful. We were very fortunate. We kept a lot of air circulating. I actually curtained off my high tunnels. I have high tunnels. I was hanging in my high tunnels and curtained them off and dried them that way, and we had air circulating, and we actually had a really good dry routine. You know, it's one of those stupid luck, you know, when a blind pig finds a nut once in a while. That was sort of us, I think, last year. We got lucky because, in all honesty, Kentucky can be very humid during certain parts, but we sort of hit a good dry period and we're able to get good dry. We bucked it right away. The stuff is stabilized and we still got stuff from last year that is, it was test, when we tested it was about 9 and 10%. We're still at about 7% with it. So it's stored up pretty good. We're happy with that because we're just getting rid of the last couple thousand pounds we had from last year. So just expect, I mean, the biggest thing is it's going to take, you know, three times as much time as you think it's going to and about double the space for drying and bucking. Bucking was the biggest, where you're stripping out the flower, was our biggest time constraint, you know. And we got it down as you go along and as you're doing bigger. You know, we were really small at 18. It didn't really affect us. Last year, we went a little bit bigger, well, a lot bigger. And then we realized constraints on time and everything. And in Michigan, I mean, you're usually going to be drier in the fall too, up until October when it rains every day.
Yep.
But so, yeah, mold will be an issue. And, you know, you spend all that time, you know, doing a beautiful plant in the field, getting it hung up and doing a beautiful job with everything, only to have a mold while you're hanging it. Yeah, that did happen to some Kentucky growers too. Saw that. And yeah, that's a sad moment.
And so on a science end of things, Scott, I mean, what do you do for mold remediation? I mean, is it possible to save the crop, or what have you seen from some of your experiences on that? Is it based on how well you're drying, or what can be done to remediate with mold?
Well, I think, you know, when you start talking about remediation, you're kind of in the hole already to start with.
Right.
You know, one thing with both our hemp growers and our cannabis, our marijuana growers, is that we want to always start with an ounce of prevention. Prevention is better than remediation. So in your drying barns and wherever you're going to be processing, take the time to do environmental monitoring, swabs, make sure that you sanitize the facility as best as you can. I know that for the typical grower, that may not make sense, but you're not, you need to make sure that you reduce yeast and mold spores in your drying facility as much as possible, even though you're going to be bringing in a product that might carry that on there. Reduce it. Don't have it on your surfaces. That's one way to start. Beyond that, you're almost, when you start trying to remediate it off the product, now you're really getting into that medical marijuana kind of category. And if you're looking at processes like freeze drying, or if you're looking at UV lights and things like that, I mean, there are mechanisms in which you can treat that kind of stuff. But I don't know if it's economically feasible for industrial hemp versus, versus the cannabis industry. So I think maybe Tony would have a better idea about the economic structure for something like that.
Well, what we did in one of our, we had some water settling in on one area. And some of the hemp that was actually touching the ground because it was too tall got mold on it. We went in there, we just pulled it out, and we destroyed it. I mean, we didn't even try to remediate it. We just took that as a hit and then just got rid of it, got it out of there. And then, yep. Then you put in the dryers. But yeah, we're being air dryers that we are. I know that mold issue, unless it's you're getting it from the field, isn't much of an issue for big dryers and stuff. But some of the boutique harvesting that we're doing and the plants that we're doing for some of the boutique industry don't want dried hemp. They want it air dried because they believe that it affects the cannabinoids and stuff levels mm-hmm. a little differently. So we got that from some of our buyers last year that they mm-hmm. were happy that we weren't, putting it into a dryer. But there is always that risk. And for me and for us, it was just a matter of trying to control it on the front end, like you were saying, Scott, culturally, yep. Leaving space, you can't pack it in as tight because you're going to have to let air flow. It's like anything. If you're going to grow in a greenhouse or in a high tunnel, you got to let air flow or you are going to get disease issues because you get stagnant, wet air, and then it becomes an issue.
Right. And I think, your integrated pest management is key. Making sure that, however you're, whether it's organic or not, making sure that you're handling your pest management in your field, because any time that you allow something else in there, like a borer or a hopper, they're opening up that tissue to exposure. And then you open, once that plant is open, now you've got a place for pathogens and molds and yeast to get in there and create colonization locations, and you want to minimize that. It's all prevention.
I want to bring up a couple. Go ahead, Tony.
Oh no! I was just going to add to what Scott was saying. It was interesting because that was mentioned a while back. Last year we had a really bad earworm issue on the buds, and they're wondering how that was going to carry over. I'm not sure if the entomology department at UK came away with anything, concrete, but that is an interesting observation that, you are opening up the plant to other issues when you get that. Like in Kentucky, the earworm was our major issue last year.
Yep. So in terms of, Scott, how you're talking about the science of the hemp plant and how it's a, I guess the right phrase would be bioaccumulator in terms of how much the plant, sucks up. What have been your experiences with soil types and fertilizers and what farmers are putting out there in the ground and how it's affecting the hemp plant? I mean, is it all over the place? Are fertilizers kind of like the seed industry in terms of what can be trusted? I mean, what's going on out there with fertilizers and into the dirt and what's then getting up into the plant?
Be careful. I think that's, again, it's a buyer beware. Don't think that you have to buy specialty because you're doing hemp. But be smart, because the cannabis species will bioaccumulate heavy metals. In fact, it's been used for environmental cleanups. It's very good at bioaccumulating heavy metals. So you want to make sure that any product you're putting out does not contain heavy metals. I know a lot of people like to use things like seaweed and stuff like that. Some kelp products, depending on where the kelp is harvested, can be high in heavy metals, particularly arsenic. So make sure that any product that you're using, that you either have a certificate of analysis for the things that you don't want, just as much as the things that you do want. And if they don't have it, get it tested. We do heavy metals analysis in the sap on plants, particularly for our medical cannabis growers, to make sure that they're not getting uptake on certain things. There's some research out there right now that's showing that humic acid additives, biostimulants, actually help to distribute cannabinoids more evenly across the plant, rather than them being more concentrated in the bud, which, if you had a variety that tended to be high in THC, might facilitate helping you get through at a little bit lower if you were putting in some humic acid. But it's also going to lower all the cannabinoids more evenly, spatially distributed across the entire plant. So but that's, again, this is early research. There's also some early research that says that there's a disproportionate, the higher the nitrogen, the lower the THC. So if you are trying to maybe reduce your THC, maybe a high nitrogen application could potentially lower some THC levels. But again, this is all early research, and I don't think it's documented real well yet.
Okay. Tony, what have you seen out there, in the fields with what other farmers are doing? Is there a certain amount of...
Sorry. A lot of our growers that we have been working with, our co-op, we all went with a chicken litter. There's some major chicken manufacturers. Inorganic, you are allowed to use things like that as long as you get a purity statement from a farmer. And you do have to be careful. I mean, for us, what we have to be careful of in Kentucky is if you're going into fields that were heavily farmed with tobacco for years, because some of the stuff that you're talking about bioaccumulating, any like lead or any heavy metals and stuff, from some of the stuff that was used on tobaccos, through the 60s and 70s, that becomes an issue, because obviously the hemp will pull that out. So we always tell people, when you're going into an area, do a full spectrum soil test, look at everything. And like Scott was saying, not just what you want, but also what, you don't want. And that'll give you a good view. And I'm sure like up in Michigan, maybe where there was orchards and stuff, because they used to spray some pretty nasty stuff, like an old orchards, if I remember correctly. Wasn't there like a lead arsenic or something like that? So I was like wondering, how that accumulates through the years and everything like that. I don't know. So it's just, you got to be extremely careful. And being organic, here, just like in the hemp industry, in the organic industry, there's been so much growth. There are a lot of people skirting. So you got to really know and do your due diligence on whatever you're buying, and know what you're buying and where it's coming from. And as long as it, meets your demand. As far as the amount that we're using, I always use like tomatoes and sweet corn. I always looked at them as sort of my, as far as nitrogen, how many nitrogen units we adding, We did great with just 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And this was from Tilden Pasture that we were doing. And some people go up to those side dress maybe with 20 to 30 pounds in July or beginning of August. We did great, and I didn't do any this year either. I mean, the plant's incredible. I think people overlove it a little bit and they overdo it. And, you know, I think as we get more data, more research done on it, we'll definitely be able to tune it in a lot better as to what the nutrient requirements are and what you can get away with and, you know, what you don't have to do. And as a farmer, you're always looking for, you know, what's the cost benefit ratio of anything that you do. So
right.
I think as we go along, it'll definitely become a lot better for us all.
Scott, how, you know, the pesticides, the heavy metals, a farm had been used for tobacco or something in the past. I mean, how long does this stuff really stay in the soil? Is it years and years and years? I mean, what is, you know, if someone's like, oh, don't worry about it, it hasn't been a tobacco farm for 20 years. You know, how deep do you need to go into the soil to really get the history or to know that you've got good dirt? I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, heavy metals aren't really going to go anywhere. Most heavy metals, unless you've got a very acidic soil, they don't leach much. Pesticides metabolize, you know, in a variety of different ways. So depending on what the pesticide or herbicide would be, it could be extremely variable. I mean, what your biggest concern is what the root zone space is for your cannabis. So the depth of your root zone is your depth of concern. You know, I would worry, you know, right now my concerns would be, you know, glyphosate. If I were going into a field that had been mostly corn or soybean, I would be looking at glyphosates and things like that. Particularly if, depending on what the what is the hemp going to be used for? If it's going to be used for fiber, it's not a big deal. If it's going to be used for a consumable, then you've got a bigger issue that you need to be probably pay attention to. Heavy metals, yeah. I mean, like Tony was saying, you could go into some orchards. Historic orchards will have high levels of arsenic and stuff, even just from stone fruits. Seeds and stuff have arsenic in cherry pits and stuff like that. So, but we've also used arsenates and other products historically, you know, in the past, and that's built up in some soils. So,
interesting. Well, in terms of kind of wrapping it up here for today and the science, and this has been an unbelievable conversation with both you guys, and this could go on for the rest of the day. You know, sometimes we get inquiries for folks that are exporting oil, CBD oil, to some extent, you know, outside the United States. It's interesting to see the demand of hemp being exported from the United States. Tony, what is the street value of a pound of hemp right now, or decent extracted oil? What is the commodity market like that you're seeing for the value of hemp?
We've seen like winterized crude, like a broad full spectrum, you know, organic, maybe $400 to $500 a kilo. I think it's going back up. It's been a while since I've been into that. What we've learned as growers is we had to vertically integrate. So we're actually doing splits, processing, and then we're in the mode right now of actually selling our own products, is getting that out there. So and a lot of that just had to do with just the huge glut that was there in 2019. And that's the hangover and then COVID and everything else that sort of hit us in the face this year. So I'm not real sure. And, you know, and then you get into, you know, you got your isolate, you got your full, you got your broad spectrum. And then like with us being organic, I don't know. I've seen it as low as everybody's, like somebody in Kentucky, they're brokering for $2 a pound right now for the hemp, which is artificially low. And I think the guy was just trying to rip off farmers at that point.
All right.
So it's hard to say, you know, I really don't have a good feel for that.
That's okay. I just wanted to see what you thought. Scott, are you getting, I mean, on the lab end of things, are you having folks double check other test results, or they're looking for how good their product is to export, or what are you seeing on the lab end of things for more of the economy of it?
I think we get some double checking when somebody doesn't believe the data they're getting from a state lab, or they think that they, you know, they've got a broker, you know, they're desperate to get it sold. They've got a broker. The broker wants confirmation on the potency that, and the, you know, and the product's been sitting in storage for 6 months. You know, remember these cannabinoids have a half-life of about 6 months. So, okay. You know, they want to know, you know, how has it changed in storage? And sometimes the brokers will ask for further analysis, like they want pesticide analysis and et cetera. So I think that's what I've seen, you know, from a standpoint of the economics on it.
Are you getting samples that are, you know, tell us about, I mean, have you gotten some samples where you've done, you know, additional tests for a broker and there's been a lot of pesticides or heavy metals or just some strange things come out of the lab?
You know, we usually have to, on a lot of stuff, because, you know, we don't have a compliance, safety compliance license with cannabis yet, we're hesitant to take on any flower products at this point. So we do a lot of referral on that. You know, we work with live tissue during the growing stages, but as far as finished product, we'll refer them. We work with Crop Health Labs out of Oregon. You know, that's a partnering lab that we work with. So if there's something along those lines with flower, then that's a lab that we'll partner with until we get our safety compliance licensing in place. You know, that way, because sure, we just don't want to jeopardize anything like that.
Understood. Well, everybody, this has been an amazing webinar with a lot of information. I think it's probably going to lead to another one. And Scott and Tony, I want to personally say thank you for coming on board and helping us out and giving your insight and your experiences, because that's important for the industry and the folks out there, and that we can all learn from. So this slide and this webinar will be put up on the PHRFSI website. And so if you would like to get in touch with myself and the services that Perry Johnson offers in terms of certifying crops, processes, good manufacturing practices, things of that nature, our information is there. And if you would like to reach out to Tony or Scott in terms of their experiences with farming and the laboratory end of things, I think if after watching this webinar, I think you would know that either one of these gentlemen is an amazing resource for that. So I just want to say thank you to everybody for attending, and we'll get this up on the website, and have a great rest of your day. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks. Take care.
Tony.
Yeah, you too, Scott. Good meeting you, and we'll be probably talking, Brett. Take care.
Take care, Tony.
Have a good day, everybody. Bye.